arms of mine. They are lonely, lonely and feeling blue.
Well, it's 5:05 and it is time for our weekly conversation with our friend, writer and critic Colin Fleming. And this time around, we talk about one of the greats of soul and pop music, Otis Redding, that 1962 recording of These Arms of Mine. And for anybody who thinks that Otis Redding is only about sitting on the dock of the bay, Colin, there is so much more to him than that.
Otis Redding was in many ways little about sitting on the dock of the bay. That came, of course, at the very end of his life. That's the song, though, you will tend to hear on the oldie station as you're tooling around in your car, and you might whistle along to the end. Actually, the people in Otis Redding's life were not keen on sitting on the dock of the bay. They didn't want him doing that song. They thought it was kind of like against his musical rep as this pioneering soul musician. He wanted to do something more introspective, though. But yes, a very variegated, rich career.
Yeah, even guys like Donald Duck Dunn, a lot of the Stax crew, weren't all that impressed with not only the song, but the mix that they put together of that.
They wanted nothing to do with it, really. In fact, even his wife, Zelma, didn't like the melody. She thought it was unconventional. And it makes me think about someone like Schubert, where he was going off in a different direction himself at one point. He wrote Winter Journey, and it's just, I don't know, one of the 30 or 40 best works of art we have in any medium. And he got no support from his friends, who regularly supported him on everything. And what that is like, to just keep going in your direction because you know, but you still have to deal with the emotional burden, I think, of not having the support of the people you care about the most and who have your best interest at heart. But it was something he wanted to do. Obviously, time has proven that Redding was doing what he ought to have done with that song.
And we talk about Otis Redding this week, first of all, because he's incredible, but also because it's hard to believe it was 50 years ago this coming weekend when he died in that plane crash.
Yeah, he was only 26 years old, and he had had such a diverse career, really. He played his first single there, which kind of came about because he accompanied a friend to the Friends recording session, and there was some time left over. They're like, oh, why don't you have a go? And he did kind of an up-tempo song that they thought was too much of a cop-off of Little Richard, which is funny because Otis Redding really doesn't sound like Little Richard very much at all. And then he did that ballad. And the ballad was kind of his thing, where he would work his alchemical soul magic, as I tend to think of it, where most of his output is ballads, but listen to Try a Little Tenderness. It is technically a ballad, but it will get you flying around your living space like your Nevin Marquardt and the 1980s Bruins just ready to pop people. It is that he starts off in this minor key, and yeah, it's technically a ballad. It oftentimes has like 12-bar blues elements, his songs, but he had this whole up-tempo, frantic ballad style that I don't really know anyone else who had that.
He was doing great work for Stax in the early and mid-60s, but Colin, was it really his closing night performance at the Monterey Pop Festival that made him a star in every genre out there?
It made him socially impactful in a way that I think people still don't even understand yet right now, because most of the crowd at Monterey was white. You didn't really have soul musicians crossing over like Otis Redding did while still being idiomatically black in terms of the style of their music. So he loved Sam Cooke, and Sam Cooke would tour with a white band and he would tour with a black band depending on who he was playing for. And so if you listen to like Sam Cooke's Live at the Copa album, it's kind of for the suburban set that, right, you might get in Greenwich, Connecticut or something, and then you listen to him in like the Harlem Square Club in Miami. It's very different. James Brown, I think he also crossed over, but you had the sense with James Brown, when you listened to him, that you were almost having this multicultural experience, like you were going to the side of town that perhaps you wouldn't do anything but drive by if you were white. And so there was kind of a novelty aspect. Otis Redding, he obliterated the notion, I feel like, of color in his music while remaining every bit as rootsy as Son House, you know, for that matter. And I think that comes down to Otis Redding's everyman persona. He doesn't sing from the diaphragm like a proper singer would. A lot of it comes from the back of the throat. You hear that with Liam Gallagher. You hear it with Bob Dylan. That's why people like that can lose their voice earlier than maybe they should. And yet, if you try to sing like Otis Redding, you're not going to come close because he was able to master that style. And I think he was really a genius of energy. And energy is a term that, when I experienced it, is usually used as a left-handed compliment. Get something like, oh, you're the hardest working man in publishing. But the reality is, energy is not something that creates a facsimile for talent. I feel that the more talent a person has, that the more energy they're going to have subsequently, the more they're going to produce. Mental and artistic muscle hustles, really. And Redding really hustled, especially if you hear his in-concert performances.
Well, and we wanted to listen to one of his live tracks here, because for people who only know him from the songs that were hits or from the studio recordings, there was so much more to him. Let's give a little listen here to one of his live recordings.
I've been loving you too long to stop now. You're tired and you want to be free. My love is growing stronger.
That's from the Live in Europe album, 1967. And I think it illustrates, Colin, that as great as he was on studio recordings, they couldn't capture the magic like those live recordings did.
A performance like that, I almost think of it, not to be like overtly lascivious, it's like a kind of edging, really, before you come to that orgastic coda at the end, which is something like almost along the lines of, to me, Handel's Messiah, the closing amen chorus, where it's just this kind of synergistic overspill of emotion between audience members and artist. And Redding certainly had that. He comes to the end of that song and he does his whole routine where he doesn't want to stop now, he doesn't want to leave the stage. And I think when James Brown, he did a version of that, I had the sense that he wanted to come out and he still had more dance moves to get through. Redding has not concluded emoting with you yet. There's a very much palpable bond that you get with him. And he was very shy. And he would, at a performance like that, he's there in Paris and he's huddled off before going on the stage in the wings. And he does not look like a man who is going to go out there and just beat the bag out of anyone else who could have been up on that stage. But once those horns started, he explodes on stage and away he goes. That Live in Europe album is, in its way, as intense as something much more volume-driven, like the Who's Live at Leeds. I don't know that there are many live albums that can come close to its, again, that notion of energy. And energy is such a rare commodity in life. You think about even doing something like radio. What's one of the things you always have to keep in mind? It's to have energy. It's not like hot takes. It's not screaming. But there has to be a certain vim in what you bring. And Redding brought that all the time. And I think it stems a lot from his musical genius.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. So what are some of the sides that people should check out that may not be as well known?
I'd say Otis Blue, which was kind of a late night, dark mood soul concept album from 1965 that was recorded basically in a 24-hour period in early July. And it's a lot of covers. Sam Cooke cover, again, Redding just, he loved Cooke so much. And it was like you didn't get really albums that didn't feel piecemeal at the time, especially with soul. If you did, they were live albums. You could have a great live soul album at the time because you weren't really dependent on the amplifier technology like you were if you were a guitar-based band. It was almost more like a jazz type thing, although it wasn't jazz. So you'd have straight through albums like that, like James Brown, the Apollo and everything, but you didn't really have a lot of studio versions of it. Sam Cooke had a really underrated album of Billie Holiday covers, but this was like kind of Redding's proto-soul Sgt. Pepper. So there's that. And then I think he has the best, I was trying to think today if there was a better one, the best posthumous album in all of rock and soul history, that being the immortal Otis Redding. And by posthumous, I don't mean like 15 years later, someone discovers, you know, you're Charlie Parker and here's some concert you did. I mean like kind of like a little bit right after you died and there was this newish material. And that album has Hard to Handle, which you've probably heard some version of. It is just like the struttiest, right? I like, in a way, kind of not PC. It's so like alpha soul male. And then his recording of Amen, which, whether you're spiritual or not, will imbue you with a certain something beyond yourself every time you listen to it.
And that plane crash 50 years ago this week not only took away Otis Redding and his incredible talent at a young age, but a very talented group, the Barqués, all but one member of that group killed in the crash, and it also had a huge impact on Stax Records.
Yeah, Stax was on their way out at that point. And that was one of the things with sitting on the dock of the bay, was the concern that we have a house sound, and this is against the grain of our house sound. And, you know, certainly it was. You see that sometimes. You saw it later with, like, Motown and Marvin Gaye, right, when he was doing kind of quasi-concept albums in the early 70s. It's like, well, this isn't really what we do. You're supposed to do, you know, I heard it from the grapevine. This is very different. So, yeah, Stax was struggling at that point. But when you mention the bands, you mention someone like, you know, the group like Booker T and the MGs. I think, like, Steve Cropper, who still with us, is just one of the best guitarists, really, in rock and soul history. And if you listen to those recordings, he doesn't play a solo, like, at all. It's just not there. He's almost like the soul version of Pete Townshend of The Who. The Who would just have these wonderfully ingenious guitar arrangements, really, that were Bachian, in a sense. And Steve Cropper was kind of like the J.S. Bach for Otis Redding's powerful emoting. And that band was just, can you be tighter than that particular band? I'm not sure that you could be.
And I didn't know this. I read it last night doing a little research that Robin and Morris Gibb wrote the song To Love Somebody, intending that it would be recorded by Otis Redding. And then when he died, they ended up dedicating that song to him.
Yeah, he touched a lot of people. And he, I guess you'd say he's more known for his covers than his original compositions, but he was winning talent contests and all that and playing guitar at a very young age. His father had died, his mother supported the family, Redding pitched in. He literally was a ditch digger. And so I think that's notable, that a lot of times people who are just singers have always been singers. They don't have that musical kind of setup of memories where they're working up from chords. And he's a very chordal singer for all of the, I don't want to say histrionics, but for all of that kind of rah-rah Otis-ness that you get. So, yeah, and, you know, we were talking about Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, and that was very much, I feel like, the net result, all of that kind of pooling together, the way he thought about chords, the way he thought about arrangements, the way he would approach a vocal track. And, you know, we talk about what Hendrix would have done if he had lived. I would have been fascinated. To me, Otis Redding and what he would have done had he lived is akin to thinking about what Buddy Holly would have done. These were musical geniuses who thought through what they did in highly sophisticated ways. Holly, in ways as sophisticated as the Beatles, I think he would have gone to. In Redding, another 20, 30 years of recording, he could have been like a sort of soul Dylan.
Do yourself a favor. Go check out some of those live recordings and some of those not quite as well-known tracks of the great Otis Redding, who died 50 years ago this week. Colin Fleming with us. And next week, I'm looking forward to this as well, a conversation about horror movies and so many classic horror films that have come out during the Christmas season through the years.
If for some reason, I don't know what this does about love. Love is hell, maybe. horror movies tend to come out like at Christmas, and at Valentine's Day. So Dracula came out at like Valentine's Day in 1931, and we're going to talk about The Mummy, another universal horror from 1932, which I think has aged remarkably well and might even topple something like Bride of Frankenstein for the best of the universal horrors, and also some Val Luden-produced works, Cat People,
on Christmas
1943, and then the lesser-known Curse of the Cat People, which is this weird phantomagoric sort of Christmas terror dream that's also about the wide-eyed wonder and love that we find in a child's heart.
Can't wait. That's next Tuesday. Colin Fleming, every week with us here on Downtown. Colin, thanks so much, as always.
All right. Thank you, sir.